Welcome to this deep dive, exploring the world of the Southern Negro, like during and after slavery.
Yeah, it's a fascinating look at this intersection of economics and religion.
Exactly. And we're going to be drawing insights from two very different but important voices, Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah, two giants of this era who offer really compelling and sometimes contrasting perspectives.
Absolutely. So let's dive right in. And to start, I think it's important to understand the moral and religious landscape of slavery itself.
Yeah, initially there was some tolerance towards converting slaves to Christianity.
Right, like the thinking was that it would make them more docile and obedient.
Exactly, but as the South's economic dependence on slavery grew, particularly with the rise of the Cotton Kingdom,
This created a huge ethical dilemma.
a huge dilemma because how do you reconcile the Christian teachings of love and brotherhood?
With the brutal reality of owning another human being.
Right, exactly. And what we see is a gradual shift, a move towards denying the full humanity and brotherhood of Black people.
So basically, they started to dehumanize them to justify the exploitation.
Sadly, yes, it became easier to perpetuate the system if you convince yourself that those you're enslaving are somehow less than human.
It's chilling to see how economic interests can warp even the most fundamental moral principles.
Absolutely, but even amidst this darkness, there were these flickers of hope.
What do you mean?
Well, we see the emergence of some truly remarkable Black preachers, figures like Harry Hoser, George Lael.
Andrew Bryan, Lotte Carey, John Chevis.
Precisely, these individuals defied the odds and became powerful voices within their communities.
Yeah, they challenged the status quo, inspired their congregation.
And really paved the way for future generations of Black religious leaders.
But their very presence, their growing influence, it must have rattled the white establishment.
Of course, the thought of slaves being educated, able to read and interpret the Bible for themselves was terrifying to slaveholders.
And there was always the fear of slave uprisings, which were often led by preachers.
Exactly. So they cracked down even harder, enacting stricter laws to restrict Black religious gatherings and education.
Like making it illegal for slaves to preach without a white minister present.
And ultimately, we see the complete segregation of churches along racial lines.
A stark contradiction to the very principles of Christianity. Du Bois actually shares a really powerful story about this in his writings.
Oh, yeah, what's that?
He talks about this Black man who disrupted a white revival meeting simply by being present.
Wow, just his presence, his Blackness, was enough to cause chaos and disrupt their service.
It speaks volumes about the level of prejudice that was ingrained within Southern Christianity at that time.
Absolutely, it's a powerful image. And now, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about Booker T. Washington's perspective on the economic development of Black people during slavery.
Okay, so he obviously acknowledged the horrors of the institution, but he also pointed out some unexpected skills and values that slaves acquired through their forced labor.
Yes, and this is where Washington's views can sometimes surprise people.
How so?
Well, he argues that in some ways, Southern slaves receive more expensive trade training than free Black people in Northern cities.
That's kind of a surprising reversal, right?
Exactly. And the reason for this was purely economic. You see, a skilled slave was more valuable to their owner.
So they had an incentive to invest in their training, not out of altruism, but for profit.
Precisely. It's a stark reminder of the dehumanizing nature of the system.
Absolutely. But Washington goes further, arguing that this economic progress, however it was achieved, laid the foundation for moral and religious growth.
He firmly believed that economic self-sufficiency was the key to unlocking a person's potential, both morally and spiritually.
Okay, I'm following you.
And to illustrate this point, he uses the story of Mr. James Hill.
Tell me about Mr. Hill.
So he was this formerly illiterate farmer who, after learning to read and write, managed to buy his own land and transform his life through agricultural innovation.
So he basically became a successful farmer, a respected community leader, and a devout Christian.
Exactly. A classic rags-to-riches story, but with a deeper message about the link between economic independence and personal growth.
Right. It wasn't just about material wealth, it was about empowerment and self-respect.
Exactly. And Washington applied this same philosophy to his approach to missionary work.
Interesting. How so?
Well, he believed that teaching practical skills like farming or carpentry was just as important, if not more important, than focusing solely on abstract theological concepts.
I see. So it's about meeting people where they are, addressing their immediate needs and empowering them to improve their lives.
Precisely, he saw this direct connection between economic upliftment and spiritual receptivity.
So the idea is that if you help someone improve their life in tangible ways, they're more likely to be open to your message.
Exactly. And he uses some interesting case studies to support this idea.
Oh, like what?
Well, for instance, he talks about Tuskegee graduates who went to Africa to teach cotton cultivation techniques.
And how this led to a natural embrace of Christianity by the local population.
Precisely, the people saw the positive impact of these skills, the improvement in their lives, and they associated that with the religion of those who taught them.
It's a very different approach to missionary work than what we often see, where the focus can be solely on converting people to a belief system without necessarily addressing their material needs.
Yes, and Washington contrasts this with what happened in Liberia, where the focus was heavily on religious teachings, but without a corresponding emphasis on economic development.
And what was the outcome there?
Well, progress was limited without the means to improve their material lives. The people remained mired in poverty and struggled to embrace these abstract teachings.
It highlights the importance of that practical foundation, right?
Absolutely. It's about creating a sense of agency of hope that can then translate into moral and spiritual growth.
And this becomes even more critical as we move into the period after emancipation, which brings its own unique set of challenges and opportunities.
Right, which is a perfect segue into our next discussion.
Yeah, let's delve into that next.
So imagine, like, you're a newly freed slave suddenly thrust into this world where you're legally free but still facing all these immense barriers.
Yeah, it must have been a really daunting transition, to say the least.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest hurdles they faced was this ingrained notion that manual labor was degrading.
Right, a legacy of slavery where work was associated with forced servitude and oppression.
Exactly. And this is where industrial schools like Tuskegee, you know, founded by Booker T. Washington, really played such a vital role
in teaching the dignity of work and fostering economic independence.
Precisely, they provided these practical skills, you know, instilled this strong work ethic and really empowered Black people to create a better life for themselves and their families.
And the impact of these schools was undeniable. Washington cites some really impressive statistics to support this.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Well, for instance, he points out that a negligible number of Tuskegee graduates ended up in prison.
It really speaks volumes about that connection between economic stability and moral conduct, right?
Absolutely. When people have the means to support themselves, they're less likely to resort to crime.
Exactly. It's a powerful testament to the transformative power of education and economic empowerment.
For sure. But while these Black communities were striving for progress, the South as a whole was dealing with its own set of post-Civil War challenges.
Yeah, the South was in a state of upheaval, trying to rebuild their economy while still clinging to these old ways of thinking and prejudices.
It seems like a recipe for conflict. So how did they try to address these challenges?
Well, Washington outlines four main approaches that the South took to solve these economic problems after the war. The first and perhaps most shocking was re-enslavement.
Wait, they actually tried to bring back slavery after the Civil War?
Yeah, it's crazy, right? But they did, though. These attempts ultimately failed.
So how did they try to do that?
They tried to control Black labor through all these restrictive laws like vagrancy statutes and apprenticeship systems that basically forced Black people back into servitude.
So much for a fresh start. So what was the second approach?
The second was serfdom or peonage, another exploitative system that trapped Black people in this cycle of debt and poverty.
How did that work?
Essentially, Black people were forced to work off debts, often incurred through these unfair sharecropping arrangements or labor contracts, with little opportunity to become independent.
It sounds like a system designed to keep them marginalized both economically and socially.
Exactly, and it often led to social unrest and violence.
Okay, and the third approach?
The third was the rise of a Black professional class.
So Black doctors, lawyers, teachers, entrepreneurs serving primarily Black communities.
Exactly. It was a sign of progress, you know, a testament to the resilience and determination of Black people to create a better life for themselves, but it also reflects this reality of segregation.
Right, where Black people were often excluded from mainstream white society.
Exactly. And the fourth approach,
okay,
Washington calls it the group economy.
What's that?
It refers to this development of a self-sufficient economic ecosystem within Black communities.
So Black-owned businesses, banks, and institutions serving the needs of their own people.
Precisely, driven by necessity, you know, to create opportunities in a world that was often hostile and discriminatory.
It's a remarkable example of how, even in the face of adversity, Black people found ways to build and sustain their own communities.
Absolutely, a testament to their strength and ingenuity.
But this brings up this glaring contradiction in the South's approach to its economic problems.
Oh, what do you mean?
Well, on one hand, they desperately needed skilled labor to rebuild their economy and compete in this rapidly industrializing world, but on the other hand, they were so resistant to giving black people the education and opportunities they needed to thrive.
Right. It's like shooting yourself in the foot. Their own prejudices and desire to maintain white supremacy ended up hindering their own progress.
It's a theme we see throughout history.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Now, W.E.B. Du Bois brings a slightly different perspective to this discussion. He highlights this looming threat of immigration and its potential impact on black laborers.
Right. He saw both potential benefits and dangers in this influx of new workers.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So on one hand, immigration could create this greater demand for skilled labor, which could benefit black workers who'd acquired these trades through institutions like Tuskegee.
So a potential for upward mobility based on merit rather than skin color.
Exactly. But on the other hand, there was this risk of increased racial tensions if immigrants were given preferential treatment.
Which, knowing the history of the South, isn't exactly far-fetched.
Unfortunately not. And we've seen this pattern play out, right? Newcomers often pitted against existing marginalized groups.
Right. It creates this U.S. versus them dynamic.
Exactly. It's a complex dynamic with both opportunities and perils.
Yeah. It's a reminder that, you know, economic progress and social justice are often intertwined.
Absolutely.
And that the struggle for equality is rarely straightforward. But, you know, ultimately, both Washington and Du Bois really believed in the power of education and economic empowerment to uplift black communities.
They did. They saw it as the key to breaking these cycles of poverty and discrimination and to achieving true equality. And this brings us back to that fundamental question we talked about earlier.
Right. Like the moral and religious implications of denying people basic human rights and opportunities based solely on race.
Exactly. A question that still haunts us today as we grapple with, you know, the legacies of slavery and segregation.
Yeah, for sure. And Du Bois, in his writings, throws down this powerful challenge to those who clung to the belief in black inferiority.
What's that?
He basically says, if you truly believe that black people are inherently incapable of achieving the same level of success as white people, then give them the same opportunities, the same access to education and resources, and let's see what happens.
Like put up or shut up.
Exactly. Right? Give them a level playing field. And if they thrive under those conditions, well, it dismantles the entire foundation of white supremacy.
It exposes the lie for what it is.
And it forces us to confront the true roots of inequality, not in some inherent difference between races, but in the systems and structures that have been designed to privilege some at the expense of others.
Precisely. It's a challenge that resonates deeply even today as we continue to grapple with these issues of racial and economic justice. You know, we see the echoes of this history and the disparities that still exist.
It's a stark reminder that the struggle for equality is far from over, and that we all have a role to play in dismantling these systems of oppression and creating a more just and equitable society.
Absolutely. And by understanding this complex interplay of economics, religion, and race in this pivotal period of American history, maybe we can gain some insights into how to address the challenges we face today.
Food for thought indeed. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, you know, exploring the world of a Southern Negro. We hope this has been enlightening and given you some new perspectives to consider.